From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's open our podcast this week with a question that sparked some heated comments on the show. On Thursday, we broadcasted with a live audience from the Little Theater in Rochester, and the subject was Vietnam, because next month, PBS and WXXI TV will debut the new documentary film series from Ken Burns titled The Vietnam War.
One of our audience members asked a question about losing the war and what it means if we can't admit we did, in fact, lose it. You'll hear responses from Marine Captain John White, then from Alan Levin, better known as Brother Weeze, who served in Vietnam. And finally, you'll hear Max Levine, a longtime anti-war activist.
If we have such a culture in America where we can't admit that we lost wars, how does then that affect us making decisions whether we're going to go to the next war?
Gary, thank you. Let's start with John White. Did we lose the Vietnam War, and does that impact our ability to kind of reason about future wars?
I was giving a speech in North Carolina several years ago. There was a Vietnamese gentleman in the audience. At the conclusion of the speech, a little Q&A time, my introduction included the fact that I was a Vietnam vet. He stood up, asked nothing about the content or the eloquence of my speech. He simply said, "Who do you think lost the war?" And I said, "Both of us." And I think from a perspective standpoint, as we go into these things and we take a look at, as Henrietta suggests, we look at Korea now, we look at Syria, we look at all of the problems in the Middle East, it's a very, very difficult thing to say who's going to and who will win. It's a loss on both sides.
Brother Weeze.
First of all, I think that everybody that died lost the war, and that's a damn shame. And I also like to say that I do know that this country can't lose, and Donald Trump definitely can't lose. But we can't lose, and I don't understand how you, if you're a sports fan, you can't say that Vietnam was a loss when the name of Saigon turned into Ho Chi Minh City. I don't know where the W and the L goes, but what's so terrible about the fact that we did a terrible thing and we did not come out with any kind of win, and 58,000 dead brothers? I'm never going to change my attitude about that. I understand the fact that people like Captain White has something inside. He went through a terrible, terrible time. So a lot of people can't do things like that and take the L, but it just seems like a fact to me, and it doesn't bother me.
But, Brother Weeze, I didn't hear John say we won the war.
No. He said both teams lost. I know how he feels, and I don't want him to feel any other way. But win and lost, as soon as you go, you're losing, and that's just the way I feel, and it's a terrible, terrible situation.
But does that mentality, that grappling with it, affect our ability to reason about whether to get into future wars?
I doubt it.
Apparently
I
not.
Wish it did.
Oh, you're saying
it did, but
it's not.
You're saying it should, but it doesn't seem to impact us.
We'll take a look around.
Okay. Max, if you can keep it tight, because we've got other comments we want to make, but you were reacting to some of what Gary had to say there. Go ahead. What do you think about this?
I don't have any strong feelings one way or the other. But the truth of the matter is we lost the war. We had someone in charge in Saigon who was directing the war for the president. He never, ever gave in to the idea that we had lost the war until the very end. And we've seen pictures on TV where they threw helicopters off of ships. They met the kind of hell that the Vietnamese were put through for those that wanted to leave Vietnam because the North were about to enter Saigon. We've seen the pictures time and time again. How can we say we did not lose that war? We did. And it's in our psyche somewhere that we can't lose the war. We're in a war for 15 years in Afghanistan, and the president feels now that we need more troops to win or not to win. to at least concede that we were there to be helpful for the Afghanistani people.
Up next, what happens when someone in your family becomes addicted to heroin? Lisa Hillman never thought that would be her life. She was a successful executive, living a comfortable upper-class life, and then her son fell into drugs. First marijuana, then OxyContin, then heroin.
Hillman wrote a book about it called Secret No More. Here she is explaining her son's progression and how she and her husband had to decide whether to eventually kick him out of the house.
I was first alerted by that phone call from a high school teacher. He said Jacob might be drinking and he might be using marijuana. So Jacob went basically from drinking, and that wasn't really quote-unquote his drug of choice, to marijuana, then Oxy, then the pills. OxyContin took over. And if any of your listeners are following that story at all, you know how addictive that can be and what a scourge that is in our country right now. But that also caught up my son. This was the years of 2008 and 9. He left high school, went to the University of Maryland, College Park for freshman year in the honors program. As he tells it, that was a lost year. He was trying everything. College introduced him to drugs that he hadn't yet experienced. So while I don't know for sure everything that he's used, I suspect he's tried most things. But that was clearly a lost year. That year, then, he came home. We told him he could come home as long as he had a plan. His plan was to go to the community college and to work, which he did. They also were not great years. He did work. He did stay in the college, community college. He almost finished to getting his associate's degree, but then the drugs took over. And along the way, I finally started getting some help for him and for me. We both went to a therapist, a pretty good one in the Annapolis area, who saw Jake. We had some not so good ones early on, but we finally found one that was helpful. Nevertheless, Jake continued using, and it finally got to a point where I said to my son, my beloved 21-year-old son, and believe me, I would have cut off an arm to cure him at that point. I said to him, Jacob, if you're going to be using, you can't stay in our house. You have a choice. You can leave, which meant he would continue to use, or we'll pay for rehab. He took rehab. He wasn't ready, but he knew that he had nowhere to go. He took rehab. He tried the first inpatient rehab center at a very, very beautiful place in Maryland. I knew when we visited him that he had somehow had gotten drugs into the rehab center. They kicked him out. He came home to Annapolis, went to our rehab center that's part of the health system where I was working. And how odd was that? I'm on the board of that center, and here's my son, a patient upstairs. After 2 weeks, they sent him to Florida, where he continued his rehab. Not such a good first year, but after that first year, he ended up actually quite ill. He was injecting heroin before it was all over. And even as I say that today, Evan, the thought of my son sticking needles and poison into his veins just makes me still cringe today. It's still very, very, very surreal. After that weekend, fortunately, a friend found him and took him into detox. A counselor called me and said, your son needs rehab. Will you pay for this? Rehab is expensive. And I said, how many times do I have to pay for this? He said, tell your son, this is the last time. I said, Jacob, Dad and I will pay for this. It's the last time. It was a 90-day program. Thank God it was a 90-day program. The first time he'd been in that long. Something happened to him in that 90 days. He found a sponsor. He found AA, even though his drug was hard drugs, not alcohol. He found AA. He got a job. He moved to a halfway house, stayed with the same job actually for the next 5 years, and has been clean now for 5.5 years.
Next, sheet cake feminism might not be a term you expected to ever hear, but it's a phrase that has led to a heated debate for the last couple weeks. Tina Fey appeared on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update Summer Edition with a sketch where she called on people to stay home and eat a sheet cake instead of protesting white supremacist rallies. Some say the sketch was brilliant satire, while others say it was the epitome of white privilege.
Our phones and social media accounts blew up during this hour. We heard from people on all sides of the issue, but our guests in the studio agreed that the sketch missed the mark. Dr. Elizabeth Thorpe is a professor of communications at the College at Brockport. You'll hear her discuss why she doesn't think Faye's piece was satire. But first, here's Vanessa Cheeks, a reporter for Open Mic Rochester. on why she thought the sketch sent the wrong message.
I definitely thought when I first watched it that she was, you know, hitting satire on the mark when she was kind of poking fun at stress eating about this whole situation, basically starting with Donald Trump and kind of ending with what's happening in Charlottesville. But then when she did say, you know, this is what I would really like to say, that's kind of when my ears perked up, because that was her opportunity to kind of make it very clear about what her message was. And her message ultimately was to stay home and not engage. And what kind of stresses me out, you know, as a Black woman, is that we engage. We have to engage. People of color do so, and we have done so in order to regain our rights. So it's kind of like saying that they're going to leave us behind to kind of just sit home.
And so I guess it sounds like you think in that last minute, her summation, she had a chance to pivot and say, okay, I've been joking about the cake. And then we all stress eat when we're feeling that kind of strain.
Yeah.
But now's the time to get beyond stress eating and get out of the streets.
Yes, and get out.
But she did the opposite.
She did the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was before that joke about Sally Hemings, and it was just kind of all very poorly placed. And like I said, it just seemed as if she had that opportunity and she kind of gave it away and made it very clear that the intention was to ignore these people. And, you know, they're not ignoring us. They're making it clear, they're coming out and they're showing that they support their ideas, and we should do the same.
Tina Fey's defenders include Playboy magazine's Tom Carson, who wrote a piece called "The Brilliance of Tina Fey's Cake Satire Explained." And he went on to say that this was just satire, and she was using the cake to expose the hypocrisy of lazy sheet cake feminism. You buy that?
I don't buy it, because it assumes that we don't know what a joke is. We know what satire is, you know, and if you're not 100% sure, you can Google it. And we know it's a joke. We know what it was, but it doesn't make it funny and it doesn't make it right. So.
Okay, and before I go to the other guests, I just want to also ask you, I saw on Twitter, you were kind of admonishing even local bakeries to say, hey, slow down before you start cranking out feminist sheet cakes, which we actually saw bakeries across the country jumping on the Tina Fey's commentary and saying, hey, pick up your American flag feminist sheet cakes. And,
yeah.
And your feeling on that was, see, look, even if it was meant to be a satire, it didn't land, because this is what people are doing. They're buying cake.
It didn't land. And I think in general for businesses, before you kind of use these movements for sales or marketing purposes, you really need to understand what backlash is going to be with it. And with social media, it comes quickly, so you can definitely look it up without wasting too much time. What I will also say is, if you're a bakery and you are not a Black-owned or Jewish-owned bakery, like she said in her skit, you really have no right to be peddling any type of pastries based off of this incident, based off of any movement, you know, that doesn't apply to you. I think it's and grotesque, basically.
Dr. Thorpe.
So I find the satire question to be interesting and maybe a little bit disingenuous. I think we throw around the round word satire a lot when really what we're just talking about is exaggeration and political comedy. Satire is something that's very specific. Like if you go to the urtext of satire, right, you look at A Modest Proposal. He spends pages and pages and pages of saying the exact opposite of what he really means. And in the last page, he provides sort of a textual analysis key in which he says, certainly we should not do the following things, and then lays out exactly what we really should do. And that's what satire does. It uses literary irony to say, here is the exact opposite of what I really intend. If you look at this sketch as satire, then it completely falls flat, because she goes through, here's the exact opposite of what I mean, and then when given the opportunity to give that textual analysis key, here's what I really mean, the answer is stay home. So I don't see the satirical element in it, because I don't think she's saying the opposite of what she means and encouraging us to be our best selves. She's just saying what she means throughout the entire time. That's not satire. It's political humor, yes. It's exaggeration, yes, and it's certainly plugging into the current discourse, but it doesn't fit any definition of satire. And we use satire as a catch-all for things that are political or uncomfortable or exaggerated or even carnivalesque, but satire is a specific thing. And when we throw that term around and we forget what it means, it becomes a catch-all for bad politics. And what we saw here, I think, was just kind of peak white feminism at work. And to explain it away as satire devalues both role that satire can play. I think if you look at the difference between Stewart and Colbert was a satirist, Stewart was a comedian, and they both had their roles to play, but they were very, very different roles. Satire is when you're saying the opposite of what you mean and then providing the textual clues for us to figure that out. That's not what happened here. What we saw was a woman telling us to stay home. And when the political lines are being drawn with the bodies of certain people in certain marginalized communities, that's a dangerous message.
Finally, maybe you missed Connections on Monday because you were out watching the eclipse. We were up on the roof. Is that a song?
It is.
But we were up on the roof. It was fun. We heard from a number of people on the show on Tuesday who wanted to share their experiences. One of the highlights of that conversation was hearing about kids who were excited about the eclipse and if the event was an opportunity to inspire them to get outside and learn more about nature.
In this clip, you'll hear Professor David Meisel from SUNY Geneseo. He says an experience like watching the eclipse can help kids develop a lifelong interest in science.
I think the people who were most profoundly affected yesterday were the young people. And those are the people that are going to rescue this whole proposition. So it's important. I mean, I had parents coming to me to beg glasses for their children. And
how that, do you say that, no, you tyrant?
Well, that's right. I gave them away. I gave my own away. And I'm going, okay, I don't have to look. I've seen enough of these. But it's true that, I mean, I got into science because of a transit of Mercury, of all things. And so I was triggered as a child to the wonders of astronomy and nature, and these kids need to get away from their computer screens and their cell phones to go out and see something. And I think there's light at the end of the tunnel as far as this is concerned, because eclipses are a marvelous vehicle. And I think NASA in particular has taken tremendous advantage of all of that. And they were everywhere. You couldn't have a line of sight that you didn't hit a NASA's badge. And I watched some of the replay last night, and I'm going, well, they're masters at it. See, they've learned how to really. National Science Foundation is so far behind and doing things for the public. They're getting there, but they're having to learn.
So NSF needs to study NASA.
Well, I think so. I think they do. But I think that they still are a lot more conservative coming to science than NASA. NASA are adventurers. You know, they have an adventure in everything. And in NSF, you don't play up the adventure. There is adventure there, but they don't make a big deal of it.
The
but
excitement,
NASA does.
Some of the, yeah, okay. And I want to follow up on one comment you make there. You talked about your own experience as a child and how yesterday was a chance to get kids off their screens. You know, you and I are not exactly the same age, but both you and I grew up when we were not addicted to screens. I mean, that's not going to go away now. So we know that's not going away. But in your experience as an educator, can you take a singular event, even if it lasts for minutes, and turn it into a lifetime? I ask because not just my 5-year-old, but everywhere we went yesterday, we were going to Ontario Beach and we stopped to get a pail and a bucket, a little bucket and a little shovel. And the guy behind the counter couldn't stop talking about it. And the people in the aisles couldn't stop talking about it. Is there a chance, even for kids today with all the other distractions, to take that one moment in one day and turn that into a lifetime?
Oh, I think so. I think that it's up to the parents to follow up on it. And that's where in the last 20 years, things have kind of fallen apart, because the parents are the controlling factor of what the children do. And as I say, when the parents came and asked for classes, I couldn't refuse it because they're doing the right thing. So I think that it's a great vehicle, but it's not the only vehicle. So all of the science organizations are tooling up because they know for the next 4 to 8 years, it's going to be a tough sell, and that they need to get out there.
And that does it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. Next eclipse, April 2024, coming to Rochester. We'll still be here doing the same thing, won't we?
Of course.
What else would we be doing? But until then, well, hope you have a great week yourself. I'm Evan Dawson. She's Megan Mack. Thanks for listening. You can always join us every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. I almost got that.
You got it. We're going to cake it.
The mobile app.
We're keeping it. The mobile app. Have a nice weekend. Talk to you
Monday.
Monday. It is Monday. Bye.